If our sensory evidence is correct, then what is wrong with Zeno's logic? Consider the sequence of distances in Zeno's paradox. 0.5 meter, 1/4 of a meter, 1/8 of a meter, 1/16 of a meter, and so on. The increments grow ever smaller. This sequence is an infinite number of terms, so we cannot compute its sum by simply adding them all up. But we can notice that although the number of terms is infinite, those terms get successively smaller. Might there be a finite balance between the endless stream of terms and their endlessly diminishing size? That is precisely the kind of question we can address by employing the concepts of sequence, series, and limit. To see how it works, instead of trying to calculate how far the student went after the entire infinity of Zeno's intervals, let's take one interval at a time. Here are the student's distances after the first few intervals. After the first interval, 0.5 meter. After the second interval, 0.5 meter plus 1/4 of a meter, equaling 3/4 of a meter. After the third interval, 0.5 meter plus 1/4 meter plus 1/8 of a meter equals 7/8 of a meter. After the fourth interval, 0.5 meter plus 1/4 of a meter plus 1/8 of a meter plus 1/16 of a meter equals 15/16 of a meter. There is a pattern in these numbers, 0.5 meter, 3/4 of a meter, 7/8 of a meter, 15/16 of a meter. The denominator is a power of 2, and the numerator is 1 less than the denominator. We might guess from this pattern that after 10 intervals, the student would have traveled 1,023 over 1,024ths of a meter. After 20 intervals, 1,048,575 over 1,048,576ths of a meter, and so on. The pattern makes it clear that Zeno is correct that the more intervals we include, the greater the sum of distances we obtain. But Zeno is not correct when he says that the sum is headed for infinity. Instead, the numbers seem to be approaching 1. Or, as a mathematician would say, 1 meter is the limit of this sequence of distances. This makes sense because although Zeno chopped her trip into an infinite number of intervals, she had, after all, set out to travel just 1 meter. Zeno's paradox concerns the amount of time it takes to make the journey, not the distance covered. If the student were forced to take individual steps to cover each of Zeno's intervals, she would indeed be in some time trouble, not to mention her having to overcome the difficulty of taking sub-millimeter steps. But if she is allowed to move at constant speed without pausing at Zeno's imaginary checkpoints, and why not, then the time it takes to travel each of Zeno's intervals is proportional to the distance covered in that interval. And so, since the total distance is finite, as is the total time, and fortunately for all of us, motion is possible after all. Though the modern concept of limits wasn't worked out until long after Zeno's life, and even Bernoulli's, it came in the 19th century, it is this concept that informs the spirit of calculus. And it is in this spirit that Jacob Bernoulli attacked the relationship between probabilities and observation. In particular, Bernoulli investigated what happens in the limit of an arbitrarily large number of repeated observations. Toss a balanced coin 10 times and you might observe 7 heads, but toss it 1 zillion times and you'll most likely get very near 50%. In the 1940s, a South African mathematician named John Kirich decided to test this out in a practical experiment. Tossing a coin what must have seemed like 1 zillion times, actually it was 10,000, and recording the results of each toss. You might think Kirich would have had better things to do, but he was a war prisoner at the time. having had the bad luck of being a visitor in Copenhagen when the Germans invaded Denmark in April 1940. According to Kerich's data, after 100 throws, he had only 44% heads. But by the time he reached 10,000, the number was much closer to half, 50.67%. How do you quantify this phenomenon? The answer to that question was Bernoulli's accomplishment. According to the historian and philosopher of science, Ian Hacking, Bernoulli's work came before the public with a brilliant portent of all the things we know about it now. Its mathematical profundity, its unbounded practical applications, its squirming duality, and its constant invitation for philosophizing. Probability had fully emerged. In Bernoulli's more modest words, his study proved to be one of novelty, as well as high utility. It was also an effort, Bernoulli wrote, of grave difficulty. He worked on it for 20 years. Jacob Bernoulli called the high point of his 20-year effort his Golden Theorem. Modern versions of it that differ in their technical nuance go by various names: Bernoulli's Theorem, the Law of Large Numbers, and the Weak Law of Large Numbers. The phrase Law of Large Numbers is employed because, as we've said, Bernoulli's Theorem concerns the way results reflect underlying probabilities when we make a large number of observations. But we'll stick with Bernoulli's terminology and call his theorem the Golden Theorem, because we will be discussing it in its original form. Although Bernoulli's interest lay in real-world applications, some of his favorite examples involved an item not found in most households: an urn filled with colored pebbles. In one scenario, he envisioned the urn holding 3,000 white pebbles and 2,000 black ones, a ratio of 60% white to 40% black. In this example, you conduct a series of blind drawings from the urn, with replacement, that is, replacing each pebble before drawing the next in order not to alter the 3-to-2 ratio. And the priori chances of drawing a white pebble are then 3 out of 5, or 60%. And so, in this example, Bernoulli's central question becomes, how strictly should you expect the proportion of white pebbles drawn to hew to the 60% ratio, and with what probability? The urn example is a good one because the same mathematics that describes drawing pebbles from an urn can be employed to describe any series of trials in which each trial has two possible outcomes, as long as those outcomes are random and the trials are independent of each other. Today, such trials are called Bernoulli trials, and a series of Bernoulli trials is a Bernoulli process. When a random trial has two possible outcomes, one is often arbitrarily labeled success and the other failure. The labeling is not meant to be literal and sometimes has nothing to do with the everyday meaning of the words. Say, in the sense that if you can't wait to read on, this book is a success. And if you are using this book to keep yourself and your sweetheart warm after the logs burn down, it is a failure. Flipping a coin, deciding to vote for a candidate A or candidate B, giving birth to a boy or girl, buying or not buying a product, being cured or not being cured, even dying or living, are examples of Bernoulli trials. Actions that have multiple outcomes can also be modeled as Bernoulli trials if the question you are asking can be phrased in a way that has a yes or no answer, such as, did the die land on the number 4? Or, is there any ice left on the North Pole? And so, although Bernoulli wrote about pebbles and urns, all his examples apply equally to these and many other analogous situations. With that understanding, we return to the urn, 60% of whose pebbles are white. If you draw 100 pebbles from the urn, with replacement, you might find that exactly 60 of them are white, but you might also draw just 50 white pebbles or 59. What are the chances that you will draw between 58 and 62% white pebbles? What are the chances you'll draw between 59 and 61%? How much more confident can you be if instead of 100 you draw 1,000 pebbles or 1 million? You can never be 100% certain, but can you draw enough pebbles to make the chances 99.9999% certain that you will draw, say, between 59.9% and 60.1% white pebbles? Bernoulli's Golden Theorem addresses questions such as these. In order to apply the Golden Theorem, you must make two choices. First, you must specify your tolerance of error. How near to the underlying proportion of 60% are you demanding that your series of trials come? You must choose an interval, such as plus or minus 1 or 2% or 0.00001%. Second, you must specify your tolerance of uncertainty. You can never be 100% sure a trial will yield the result you are aiming for, but you can ensure that you will get a satisfactory result 99 times out of 100, or 999 out of 1,000. The Golden Theorem tells you that it is always possible to draw enough pebbles to be almost certain that the percentage of white pebbles you draw will be near 60%, no matter how demanding you want to be in your personal definition of almost certain and near. It also gives a numerical formula for calculating the number of trials that are enough, given those definitions. The first part of the law was a conceptual triumph, and it is the only part that survives in modern versions of the theorem. Concerning the second part, Bernoulli's formula, it is important to understand that although the Golden Theorem specifies a number of trials that is sufficient to meet your goals of confidence and accuracy, it does not say you can't accomplish those goals with fewer trials. That doesn't affect the first part of the theorem, for which it is enough to know simply that the number of trials specified is finite. But Bernoulli also intended the number given by his formula to be of practical use. Unfortunately, in most practical applications, it isn't. For instance, here is a numerical example Bernoulli worked out himself, although I have changed the context. Suppose 60% of the voters in Basel support the mayor. How many people must you poll for the chances to be 99.9% that you will find the mayor's support to be between 58 and 62%? That is, for the result to be accurate within plus or minus 2%. Assume, in order to be consistent with Bernoulli, that the people polled are chosen at random, but with replacement. In other words, it is possible that you poll a person more than once. The answer is 25,550, which in Bernoulli's time was roughly the entire population of Basel. That this number was impractical wasn't lost on Bernoulli. He also knew that accomplished gamblers can intuitively guess their chances of success at a new game based on a sample of far fewer than thousands of trial games. One reason Bernoulli's numerical estimate was so far from optimal was that his proof was based on many approximations. Another reason was that he chose 99.9% as his standard of certainty. That is, he required that he get the wrong answer, an answer that differed more than 2% from the true one, less than one time in 1,000. That is a very demanding standard. Bernoulli called it a moral certainty, meaning the degree of certainty he thought a reasonable person would require in order to make a rational decision. It is perhaps a measure of how much the times have changed that today we've abandoned the notion of moral certainty in favor of the one we encountered in the last chapter, statistical significance, meaning that your answer will be wrong less than one time in 20. With today's mathematical methods, statisticians have shown that in a poll like the one I described, you can achieve a statistically significant result with an accuracy of plus or minus 5% by polling only 370 subjects. And if you poll 1,000, you can achieve a 90% chance of coming within 2% of the true result, 60% approval of Basel's mayor. But despite its limitations, Bernoulli's golden theorem was a milestone because it showed, at least in principle, that a large enough sample will almost certainly reflect the underlying makeup of the population being sampled. In real life, we don't often get to observe anyone's or anything's performance over thousands of trials. And so if Bernoulli required an overly strict standard of certainty, in real life situations we often make the opposite error. We assume that a sample or a series of trials is representative of the underlying situation when it is actually far too small to be reliable. For instance, if you polled exactly 5 residents of Basel in Bernoulli's day, a calculation like the ones we've discussed in Chapter 4 shows that the chances are only about 1 in 3 that you will find that 60% of the sample, 3 people, support the mayor. Only 1 in 3? Shouldn't the true percentage of the mayor's supporters be the most probable outcome when you poll a sample of voters? In fact, 1 in 3 is the most probable outcome. The odds of finding 0, 1, 2, 4, or 5 supporters are lower than the odds of finding 3. Nevertheless, finding 3 supporters is not likely, because there are so many of those non-representative possibilities. Their combined odds add up to twice the odds that your poll accurately reflects the population. And so in a poll of 5 voters, 2 times out of 3 you will observe the wrong percentage. In fact, about 1 in 10 times you'll find that all the voters you polled agree on whether they like or dislike the mayor. And so if you paid any attention to the sample of 5, you'd probably severely over or underestimate the mayor's true popularity. The misconception, or mistaken intuition, that a small sample accurately reflects underlying probabilities is so widespread that Kahneman and Tversky gave it a name, the law of small numbers. The law of small numbers is not really a law. It is a sarcastic name describing the misguided attempt to apply the law of large numbers when the numbers aren't large. If people applied the untrue law of small numbers only to urns, there wouldn't be much impact. But as we've said, many events in life are Bernoulli processes, and so our intuition often leads us to misinterpret what we observe. That is why, as I described in Chapter 1, when people observe the handful of more successful or less successful years achieved by the Sherry Lansings and Mark Cantons of the world, they assume that their past performance accurately predicts their future performance. Let's apply these ideas to an example I mentioned briefly in Chapter 4, the situation in which 2 companies compete head-to-head or 2 employees within a company compete. Think now of the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies. Let's assume that, based on their knowledge and abilities, each CEO has a certain probability of success each year, however his or her company may define that. And to make things simple, let's assume that for these CEOs, successful years occur with the same frequency as the White Pebbles or the mayor's supporters, 60%. Whether the true number is a little higher or a little lower doesn't affect the thrust of this argument. Does that mean we should expect, in a given 5-year period, that a CEO will have precisely 3 good years? No. As the earlier analysis showed, even if the CEOs all have a nice, cut-and-dried 60% success rate, the chances that in a given 5-year period, a particular CEO's performance will reflect that underlying rate are only 1 in 3. Translated to the Fortune 500, that means that over the past 5 years, about 333 of the CEOs would have exhibited performance that did not reflect their true ability. Moreover, we should expect, by chance alone, about 1 in 10 of the CEOs to have 5 winning or losing years in a row. What does this tell us? It is more reliable to judge people by analyzing their abilities than by glancing at the scoreboard, or as Benoulli